Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. This week, an Albany County Sheriff's officer who killed an unarmed man in 2018 has resigned. The sheriff says the incident has led to changes.
There's definitely some healing that, you know, that'll need to be done.
The University of Wyoming Sheep Program is transforming their wool into a new product, and they're using blockchain.
And the idea of blockchain is to be able to trace a product to its origin. This project, we probably aren't going to be able to trace it back to an individual animal, but we can trace it back to a flock at UW.
And a major wind project has been proposed for Albany County, and it's the subject of our latest I Respectfully Disagree.
Something that can really help make this dialogue more constructive is coming from a mutual sense of respect.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. This week, Corporal Derek Colling from the Albany County Sheriff's Office resigned. Colling shot and killed Laramie resident Robbie Ramirez during a traffic stop in 2018. Ramirez was unarmed. Colling was hired after having been fired from the Las Vegas Police Department following an altercation with a photographer. He had also killed two people while working for that department, and many objected when Sheriff Dave O'Malley hired him. After the death of Ramirez, many were outraged and demanded Colling's dismissal and for charges to be filed against him. A $20 million wrongful death lawsuit has been filed, and efforts are underway to try and decertify Colling so he cannot work again. Albany County Sheriff Aaron Appelhan says he can't discuss the details behind Colling's resignation, who he recently transferred to work in the detention center. But now that Colling has resigned, the sheriff says there is work that needs to be done.
There's definitely some healing that, you know, that'll need to be done between the department and the community. We knew that coming in, and both the department and the community has said as much when I took over, and so we're continuing that process as I move along through my tenure here.
Appelhan says one thing that's clear is that the department needs to do things differently.
Definitely a kind of a multifaceted approach. There is a whole host of issues that the community would like to see from their law enforcement and specifically my department. And so we've tried to work and build those partnerships in all the areas, from how we respond to people that are in mental health crisis and the services that are provided to those people within the community, training and de-escalation techniques, and trying to provide more for our officers so that we're better prepared and better equipped to handle all the situations that come our way.
Appelhan says that law enforcement has always had challenges dealing with those with mental health issues. He says their approach will involve a number of people.
Partnering with a lot of other groups and entities and doctors and hospitals and everybody that's involved with those situations to try and find a better way how we can provide help for people that are in mental health crisis and find a way to either better navigate the criminal justice system or avoid the criminal justice system altogether.
State Representative Carly Provenza has been working hard on trying to reform policing in Albany County ever since Colling killed Ramirez. She's also behind the effort to get him decertified. Provenza started the organization Albany County for Proper Policing. She's encouraged with Sheriff Appelhan's devotion to reforms, but she says this cannot be just a quick fix.
What needs to happen now is real community oversight of law enforcement to ensure that those changes stick, because we shouldn't have a change now because we have a new sheriff, and then if we have a different sheriff come, be worried about an entirely different agency. So I'm hopeful, at least particularly here in this county, that we're going to have more accountability and more transparency of law enforcement. And I think that Aaron Appelhans is invested in that.
For her part, Provenza will push for legislation that will attempt to keep officers with bad track records from being hired along with some other reforms.
We haven't changed our law enforcement statutes in decades, and I think that while there are some things that work in this state, we're certainly seeing that there are some things that don't, and I'm invested in making sure that our law enforcement serve our communities, and I believe that for the most part that they do, but how do we ensure that we've got a squeaky wheel or a bad actor in the structure, how do we ensure that they don't, you know, in lack of a better term, poison the well?
Provenza is also looking at body cam legislation to bring more accountability to law enforcement. When we come back, we will look at how blockchain might help Wyoming's wool industry. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Justin and his brother Jason did everything together when they were kids in Florida. But when they grew up, they forgot about all their old dreams until tragedy struck.
Life is obviously too short. You never know what's around the next corner. You know, if this is a dream that we had, we need to follow it. We need to do it.
Surfing with Jason. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming's climate is known to produce fine wool, perfect for spinning into yarn and creating high-quality products. And the University of Wyoming's Department of Agriculture has its own herd of sheep to study that wool. This year, they're trying something new. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel has the story.
275 female Rambouillet sheep call the pastures at UW's Laramie Research and Extension Center home, and every year before giving birth, they're sheared, producing around 10 to 12 pounds of wool each. According to UW's Extension Sheep Specialist Whit Stewart, normally UW's sheared wool is baled and sent into a commodity market. There, it loses its traceability as it's bought and sold throughout the world to be turned into products. Stewart would like to see that change.
If we're producing this high-quality product in a landscape that's really well-suited for it, shouldn't we be capturing some of that value at the state level, I think? And I mean, that's the lament of agriculture in general, right? Is we produce it here in Wyoming, but it leaves our state to be processed and value-added.
So this year, for the first time, UW's wool will be sent to Mountain Meadows Wool, a full-service mill in Buffalo that will transform it into custom blankets without it ever leaving the state. Ben Hostetler is the operations manager at the mill.
So every day we're doing something custom. And so we take it from the raw wool into a finished product, and that's a custom product start to finish. And I can't think of anywhere in the U.S. that actually does what we do.
Hostetler says the wool will be machine knitted into about 300 blankets. If there's extra wool, they may create other items.
When we go through at the end, if we have leftover, then it's a kind of a fun conversation we get to have is say, hey, we have extra wool. Do we want to make more yarn out of it? Do we want to make some other product that would go along with a blanket? Do we want to store it for next year? And we have those conversations.
After they're finished, a hand-stamped leather tag will be sewn onto the blankets with its design edition and a QR code that uses blockchain technology to show the purchaser about its production and specifically that it's UW wool. Laramie Research and Extension Center Director Scott Lake, who's also part of the UW Wool Throws project, says blockchain is becoming an important tool in the industry.
And the idea of blockchain is to be able to trace a product to its origin. In the case of animals, how it was handled, how it was treated, where it grew up. This project, we probably aren't going to be able to trace it back to an individual animal, but we can trace it back to the flock at UW, and it kind of demonstrates the capabilities of that technology.
Extension Sheep Specialist Whit Stewart says they partnered with the UW Center for Blockchain and Digital Innovations to utilize blockchain for this heightened traceability, which will continue to become more widely used.
For us, I think this pilots a broader effort that we are going to be working on to source verify not only our wool, but Wyoming producers' wool, Wyoming lamb, and also breeding stock. You know, as we trade breeding sheep across state lines, you know, having some good records on their vaccinations, you know, just their animal health. So, I mean, the blockchain application to this is just a small portion of that.
The blankets, which were designed by a UW fine arts student, will feature the UW color palette and bucking horse. According to Stewart, the design will change every year. He says this project is a first of its kind, and the revenue generated will go right back into the sheep program. But they're not ready to stop at blankets.
Long term, I'd love to see our football team wearing really high performance wool socks at the football games. I'd like to see lambs served at the stadium. I mean, I think this blanket project hopefully is creating awareness for a sustainable ag industry, and hopefully we can highlight that in the broader opportunities at the university.
The blankets will be sold for around $400, which is on par with other custom wool blankets. Stewart says they recognize the university's and the state's rich sheep production history.
It should not be a bargain basement type price, right? People's livelihoods are tied to what this is doing. I want this blanket to be accessible to everybody, but I think we've become so accustomed to products that are disposable in our society that these artisan products that are grown from our soils, grown from our ranchers, and in our state, I think has to come at a higher price point.
Blanket pre-sales will start online in July. Stewart and Lake are both confident that the project will be highly successful and could lead to an expansion of the UW sheep program. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ivy Engel.
Across the West, drought conditions are the worst they've been in nearly two decades. The dry weather is hitting farmers and ranchers particularly hard, who need water for their crops and livestock. But it's not just their bottom line that's being threatened. The effect of drought and climate change on ag workers' mental health is increasingly concerning healthcare providers. A warning for listeners, this story discusses suicide and may not be suitable for all listeners. From KSJD in southwestern Colorado, Lucas Brady Woods reports.
Mike Nolan has been a farmer for about 18 years.
I don't like gardening. Like, I like farming in the sense of, like, I like tractors, I like equipment, I like big harvests.
His farm is in the Mancos Valley at the base of southwest Colorado's snow-capped San Juan Mountains and across from the bluffs of Mesa Verde National Park. In a normal season, Nolan grows up to 7 acres of crops, anything from turnips to squash to tomatoes. This season, though, he's had to cut his crops down to less than a single acre.
These fields should be cultivated and prepped and looking good, but they're covered in grass and thistle.
That's because Nolan's farm and all of its neighbors are experiencing extreme drought conditions or worse, and that's limiting water supplies for the region's farmers. Alfalfa farmers ideally need 30 inches of irrigation water per acre per season for their crops. This season, though, some farmers in the county are only getting a fraction of an inch from their reservoirs. As a result, farmers have to make adjustments, and some of the sacrifices they're forced to make can be really hard on their mental health.
Sometimes you look in the mirror and you're like, should I be doing this? Like, does this make any sense? That stuff just builds. And it's on seasons like this, it can crack, you know, and that's the scary part.
Nolan's not the only one noticing the mental health effects that drought is having on farmers. According to data compiled by Celebrating Healthy Communities, a Colorado-based suicide prevention group, farmers and ag workers are the second highest at-risk population in the county where Nolan farms. That means they're more likely to die by suicide than almost any other occupational group. And the data show another concerning correlation. Researchers also compared the state of Colorado's drought data for the past decade with the state's suicide data for the same period. When drought conditions worsen, so does the suicide rate among farmers. JC Carica, the CEO of Southeast Health based in La Junta, isn't surprised by those findings. He specializes in behavioral health care in rural communities.
There's seasonality. I think there's peaks of anxiety, peaks of depression. It's ever flowing because it's, again, weather related or market volatility.
He also says that drought can be especially devastating.
When you see the wind come through and shear off whatever little bit of grass you had from a quarter inch of rain a couple days prior, it's kind of the carrot and the stick. And sometimes there's just not enough carrot to keep, you know, to keep people's hopes high.
Many mental health issues in the ag community can be compounded by lack of services. The answer, Karika says, is to make more of an effort to get mental health care to farmers on their level. Kate Greenberg is the Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Colorado.
As we see financial stress increase, as we've seen in the, you know, in the last decade or so, we also see spikes in suicide rates among agricultural communities.
Greenberg says her department is working with local partners across the state to get more resources to rural areas. What works in a city might not translate to agricultural communities. So, she says, resources like online training manuals or public service announcements should be written with that in mind. Colorado also maintains a crisis hotline, a free and confidential mental health resource that's available 24/7. But as climate change continues to heat up and dry out the West farmland, Greenberg says water stress will remain a challenge to keeping agriculture viable and those who do it mentally well. Back in the Mancos Valley, Mike Nolan says this year's lack of water is changing his operation in a fundamental way.
The big one was laying off everybody, which was a real bummer. Never had to do that. It was really hard to do.
But Nolan says off and on therapy has really helped.
I just look at it as a feast or famine. We're going to have a hard year this year. We'll figure it out. We'll hope and pray that it'll be different.
He says if it's not, then he'll take the year off, get a job away from the farm, and pay his bills. Then he'll see what he can do down the line. I'm Lucas Brady Woods in Cortez, Colorado.
If you or someone you know is having thoughts of suicide, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. This story is part of ongoing coverage of Water in the West, produced by KSJD and distributed by KUNC. It's supported by the Walton Family Foundation. When we come back, we'll hear a civil discourse about a controversial wind proposal. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Carbon Valley, one entrepreneur wants to help the climate by using carbon dioxide to create a new fuel for planes.
We eventually get to the point where there's no more fossil fuels being extracted for aviation, and we lock up that billion tons into a circular fuel.
We explore how this vision for carbon capture squares with Wyoming's own. I'm Cooper McKim. Find Carbon Valley under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Albany County Commissioners held a meeting for public comment on the Railtie Wind Project south of Laramie. It lasted 5 hours. That's because over the last couple of years, it's been a controversial subject that's divided the community and even led to hurtful attacks on social media. Commissioners now have 45 days to decide if they'll support it. As part of our series, I Respectfully Disagree, Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with folks on each side of the issue for a civil discourse. They came together in the Wyoming Public Radio conference room and started things off by sharing a meal.
I sit down with Kelly Schroeder and Peter Bishop at a conference table, and we all start unwrapping our sandwiches. We're trying to remember who ordered what.
This looks vegetarian.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Okay, there you go.
From some.
Yeah, this is it.
Okay. Teamwork makes the dream work.
When you're sitting down to have a hard conversation, nothing eases the tension, like sharing a meal.
Thank you. Yeah. Pickle in a bag? Perfect. Napkins? Perfect. Thank you.
While we eat, we chit-chat, getting to know each other, no pressure.
I don't know what I got either.
We'll say it. It makes sense for now. Nobody's going to check us.
Right. Let's call it that.
Yeah.
Then we put our leftovers aside.
I'm happy to get mine.
I start things out with a few reminders about how these conversations work.
You have both seen the ground rules for these conversations, but for those of you who are listening, I have asked Kelly and Peter to do 5 things for me: to share their speaking time equitably, to listen carefully and not interrupt, to keep an open mind, to not be disrespectful even if they don't respect each other's views, and maybe most importantly, to keep a sense of humor. But just to be clear, the goal isn't to convince the other person to switch sides. It's to find some kind of common ground. And with that said, let me introduce you. So Kelly Schroeder is for the Railtie Project. Kelly, tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right, well, yeah, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to Peter about all of this. So my name's Kelly, and I was born and raised here in Laramie. Then I spent some time away. I got my undergraduate and graduate degrees out in Boston, and then moved back here to Laramie about a year ago when the pandemic hit. And I think it was kind of something that was inevitable, and I always just saw myself coming back here, and it was the right time. So I'm currently working as a community organizer with Better Wyoming. I also teach yoga, I serve on the Albany County Recreation Board, and then, you know, in my free time, I enjoy getting outside as much as I can, whether it's hiking or backpacking, biking, that kind of stuff. So that's me.
Great. And Peter Bishop is against the Rail Tie Project. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Peter.
Sure. So I originally actually grew up 30 minutes north of Boston in Nashua, New Hampshire. I came out to Laramie when I was 18 to go to school because it was very affordable and it was a really good education for the cost. And then I got my degree in political science, and from there I started doing a lot of community organizing. I worked at Forward Wyoming for a while, where I helped get young people voting for the first time, mobilizing them. And then from there I worked at Better Wyoming as well, helped with issue advocacy, and really enjoyed my work there because something I was really tied to was the mission, which was to make a better Wyoming and help working class people. And it's actually funny, that mission and kind of that thought and the reason I got into organizing was one of the reasons I came out against this project, because quite frankly, and this might be controversial, but I don't see it being compatible with that mission statement. So I felt it was kind of my duty. I better stand up and make my voice heard, you know?
Yeah.
So here we are.
So it's wonderful that you guys have quite a bit in common. Your background's in Boston, which is super cool. And then the fact that you both worked and work at Better Wyoming. So, and that will probably help this conversation. So I wonder if you can start by just telling each other a little bit about your personal reasons for why you feel like this wind project means so much to you.
Yeah, sure. So I first heard of this project a little bit last year when I moved back to Laramie, and then through that I saw the conversation start to sort of ramp up, and a lot of the things that I was seeing and a lot of the things that I was hearing just seemed like honestly very harmful messaging, harmful misinformation about the project and about wind energy in general. And so that kind of, you know, that brought me to this point of, well, you know, if we're going to be building a better Wyoming and if we're going to be for renewable energy projects as we start to move away from coal, it's really important that these conversations are you know, based in fact, based in values, and that we talk to each other about, you know, what it is that's at stake here, instead of, you know, bombarding the public with all of these things that make it really, really confusing to know whether or not you're for or against a project.
To be completely honest, at some point, living in this community, I would like to start my own enterprise of some type and be invested in this community. And I sincerely worry because, and I know there's been this whole kind of NIMBY argument, not in my backyard, with the view shed and whatnot. And I think that's turning it into too simplistic of an idea. It's not just a view shed for the sake of, oh, it'd just be nice to look at something better. That has driven our economy for over 30 years. It's not just like there's going to be a few windmills and we won't notice it. This will be an irreparable change to not only our way of life. If you go out and talk to the community, the main reason people stay here is the access to the outdoors. It is the, when I went to the university, one of the things I saw was like, oh, Kirk Gowdy, Happy Jack, Vitavu. That's something like that will make me stay here.
I know that when I have interviewed people about this subject, that there has been quite a bit of controversy, and that there's been, you know, some people who felt attacked in the course of this decision-making process. I wonder if you guys can talk about it, you know, your own encounters maybe on social media, what you have experienced, how you would categorize the tone of the conversation and the decision-making process in the community.
So in regards to the tone, I mean, I think you would agree our community is pretty split on it. I've had conversations of getting yelled at and kicked out the store. I've had conversations of people crying because they're going to lose everything. I've had conversations of people who are just more mad and don't know what to do and kind of just feel despondent and feel like everything is kind of caving in on them. I've also seen people who are definitely very supportive of this project for a variety of reasons. I think we both agree that there's no like right answer. You know, it's more of like, what are you prioritizing?
Well, so I'll be honest, I don't get on my social media all that often.
That's probably the way to go.
I primarily use Instagram, I guess, and there I really haven't seen too much divisive conversations or any sort of, you know, advertising that's, you know, pro or anti rail tie or wind in general. But I have seen, like, on Facebook, is where a lot of the conversations are taking place. And I mean, I think that that's kind of understandable because that's like Facebook has become that place where everybody goes to like, exactly, to take,
shots at each other. Something I think we would both agree on. Everybody cares. Like, everybody's not doing this because they just have a bunch of free time and want to make a stink about a wind project or not a wind project. And so I think something that can really help make this dialogue more constructive is coming from a mutual sense of respect and then actually figuring out what each person's priorities are and then finding a way to commiserate what those priorities are in a way that's an equitable solution for our entire community.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, I guess. I think also, you know, adding in how that plays out on social media when we haven't really been, you know, seeing each other in person a lot lately, that's hard. And I think that that's something that I'm still, like, learning how to do as a community organizer during a pandemic is, like, how to continue these conversations online. I don't have a single answer for that.
But, it seems like one of the issues is just, like, an oversimplifying of who you think the other side, what that person is, like their stereotyping happening. I wonder if you guys could each talk a little bit about what you feel like those stereotypes might be, and what the facts are when it comes down to. And I think you've touched on this a little bit already, but just kind of like who's really for and against this wind project.
So stereotypes, I guess, like, you know, that for the stereotype of the pro wind people, I guess, could be that, you know, like we don't care about the environment, or we're not really like environmentalists. We're just here for the economy and for those 20 jobs that, that are going to be created with this project. But I think that that's, you know, not true at all. You know, like I am a lover of the outdoors, and I know everybody who I've talked to who's in favor of this project is as well. And we also value, you know, these view sheds and these animals and birds and whatnot that call this area home as well. And so I think that it's, you know, it's not very fair to think of pro wind people as not caring about the birds or not caring about the impacts on mule deer or that kind of stuff.
One thing we've seen is like, oh, it's all just wealthy landowners who just don't want their property values to go down. Are there people in the coalition who are worried about that? Totally. I mean, to say otherwise would not be, would be disingenuous. But something I've also seen is this idea of, oh, we're these provincial, we don't understand the bigger picture, like, shh, just be quiet, trust me, it's going to be good for you, you don't understand it. And I got a Better Wyoming article where it was talking and using that exact language, where it's like, oh, all these really rich, angry white landowners are just like not, actually, I don't think I said white, so I'll admit that, but are just here, they're mad, they just want to keep the old way of things, they don't want to admit that climate change is real. They're all Trumper conservatives. I'm a registered Democrat. I'm not a Trumper. I have worked and dedicated over 6 years of my life to help progressives and Democrats in the state. So to me, that was one thing that was very frustrating, because that we're being paid for our friend for oil and gas. That is not true. I decided to step up because a lot of my friends came to me and were worried, in the sense that they're like, hey, this is going to happen. I'm really worried about this. I don't know what to do. It's going to be the working class people working down at Sweet Melissa's, working down at Born a Barn, or, you know, all these places who are going to suffer. Those are the people who don't, they live paycheck to paycheck, and the one thing they have is the ability to, all of our open access, where we all treat equally, to go access our public lands.
I wonder if you guys could have a little bit of a conversation about the regulations that are on the books, and, you know, maybe what our state and local governments maybe should be doing to help these, you know, communities make sure that before one of these projects comes to town, that they're feeling like they are in agreement with what the regulations are on the books.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure. I see both sides to this. And I think, you know, one actually good thing that's come of the pandemic is that ability for people to Zoom in and provide public comment. I think that that was immensely, you know, beneficial to the legislative session that just happened. And it's been helpful for me in testifying before, like I testified before the Planning and Zoning Commission last night at like 9:45 p.m., you know, from my house. So I was able to, you know, still eat my dinner and like have, you know, be doing my other things. But I absolutely like hear you. And I agree that, you know, the way that our government is structured doesn't really like make it that inviting or that easy for people to know what's going on and to know when to give public comment. And then you get into a situation where, you know, a company submits an application to build a wind project, and then the public is like, wait a minute, hold on, like, we didn't even like think this would happen, like, let's look at our regulations again and try to go through those. The Albany County Commissioners meeting in March, when they updated the wind regulations, it seemed like there was this point of understanding at the end that accepting the updated regulations for how they were at the moment was actually best for everybody, because otherwise the old regulations would have been in place, because there needs to be this whole public process, of public comment and you know, planning and zoning needs to provide input. And so if the old regulations had been in place and ConnectGen had submitted their application process, then they'd be held to even less strict guidelines. So I think, you know, it was kind of one of those things that was like, oh, we're all like kind of, you know, this might not be like the solution that's best for everybody, but it is something that sometimes it's not in conflict.
But I would push back a little bit to where there was a few regulations that were recommended and they were not approved. They were actually voted down and the application went through. And then before that, we were talking about the county commissioner regulations. As far as I could tell, there was no real substantial change in regards to, it was kind of stuff that like the construct was like, oh, is this going to cause ConnectGen, this is no longer financially feasible for ConnectGen, then it seemed like we're not going to take that regulation, and then they pushed it through. And so, I mean, one of the things Wyoming did was, because it was so tied to the carbon-specific energy development, is they kind of thought that wind would never happen here because of public opinion, and so they routinely refused to update the wind regulations. And now it's coming back to bite us, because now companies like ConnectGen, they're like, oh, we're following the regulations, but the regulations are clearly inadequate, and on top of it, lead to little accountability for the company itself. Things I'd point to is the public comment period, the amount of that, the limited amount of discussion, and also the incomplete application. I mean, the application seemed to be approved prior to even being completed, which to me seems problematic, to say the least.
Can you say more about, like, it hasn't, to my understanding, it hasn't been approved yet.
No, it's not been approved, but it is going, I mean, it got approved by, or it got the recommendation from PNC to the county commissioners. And if you look at the history of approval for projects like this, especially with development, there's like an 80-90% chance it will go through. Like, I will be honest, we're on the losing end here. Right. We don't have much time, and it's probably going to go through.
Yeah, well, I guess back to the regulations thing, it's my understanding that the Albany County regulations are pretty much in line with the state regulations and state standards.
Right, which isn't good.
So if we see this problem with rail ties specifically, and we want to make a change for future wind development or future development of any kind, it doesn't necessarily have to be wind. Like, you know, it's hard for me to understand, you know, why the Albany County regulations maybe aren't good enough if they're being compared to something that's the same, you know?
I would point to, if you look throughout the state, I mean, there is rampant wind development. And we're making it sound like this is the first wind project in Wyoming. It is far from it. We already have three other in the county. And so, the idea that, like, we are not embracing wind, I would say quite the opposite. And on top of that, like, the regulation, as we mentioned, you said, are similar to the state. We already kind of acknowledge it, like, that's inadequate. So why would we use it as a standard for good regulation?
What I'm hearing is that you guys kind of are in agreement in that there does need to be an evaluation of like our decision-making process and regulation process. And that it seems like there's a burden on the smaller community governments, local governments, county governments, to try and figure this out by themselves, which is a Wyoming value, that sort of local government control.
Definitely.
But it seems like that this could be a place where the state might need to step in and start to help make some decisions, bring in experts, help these county governments make their decision making. Is that what I'm hearing? Kind of.
I would agree with that encapsulation.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Also relying on, you know, like you've said, local knowledge, not just kind of like top-down, you know, expert knowledge, but also just kind of, you know, listening to the people of the community, and not only the people who live in the area where this is going to be built, but also people, you know, who stand to benefit from this and who can see that, yes, there are impacts, but also there are benefits to this as well. And figuring out, you know, that balance. I definitely don't envy the county commissioners or the Planning and Zoning Commission when they have to like confront these difficult decisions.
I wonder if maybe you guys could put your heads together and offer some advice to some of the other, as you mentioned, Peter, this is something that is going to be coming down the pike for lots of communities. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you guys could join together and offer some advice to some of these communities going forward.
Don't be insecure. You know your stuff. Like, there's a lot of collective knowledge that you've generated over how many years. If you know something's fishy, follow your gut. Why do we need the state potentially be involved in regulations? How is a small community of 30,000 people that has a limited budget, hence why we're considering this project, is going to go up against a multi-billion dollar multinational energy equity firm that has access to PR, has access to organizing funding, has access to ingratiate themselves to the community for how many months beforehand? We don't have that. I don't think it's the worst thing to be like, hey, maybe like, I want to make sure that I have a say in this if I'm going to be the one taking on all the burden.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that, Kelly? Would you add anything?
Yeah, I would definitely add, my advice for communities going through this kind of stuff, specifically to young people in the communities, is to make public comment, like do the scary thing. Mm-hmm. I think kind of what you were saying, like when I testified before the county commissioners in March, that was my first time ever giving a public testimony, and I was like shaking the whole time. And I probably talked for 30 seconds, felt like 3 hours, but then after that, it was like so easy, and it was actually kind of fun to like continue the conversation and hear people from the other side, and to follow the discourse that's happening, in the paper and online and all of that. So I think my advice to the community is to like, don't be afraid to like voice your values and get involved in the public process. And because when your friends and your neighbors see you doing that, it makes the barrier easier for them to get involved as well.
Maybe my last question, once this decision is being made to build or not to build, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be disappointed. Mm-hmm. And we have to continue to live together as a community. And so I wonder if you guys could talk a little bit about the process of bringing the community together once the decision is made.
Once that happens, I'm hopeful that we'll all be able to like take a breath and look at each other and be like, hey, I'm sorry that you lost something that you cared about, or I'm happy for you that you gained something that you care about. And let's, figure out how we can, talk about this issue in a way that, isn't degrading of the other side, or like a ha-ha, I told you so, or look at that kind of a thing, but like acknowledging, like you lost or you won, and, kind of acknowledging that emotion behind that, I think is really important as a first step, at least.
I would take that one step further and say, why is the emotion there?
Yeah.
Is like a more helpful, like what is going on that people are so fired up about, and what are those motivations? Because I think, as I said, we all come with very similar values in this community. I'm not talking about like values and like political values and things like that.
Right.
More of just like values to the way we live our life. And I think we need to get back to that. We have the same values, but we need to have more trust in each other, that we come from that place, and that when we bring up concerns, it's not because we're uneducated, it's not because we're just being selfish or anything like this, it's because we legitimately we do have an emotional tie to this. I mean, I won't minimize emotion in the sense that like a large reason why people are here, a large reason why people live in this community is an emotional experience. And so to minimize that also is a form of kind of tone policing, to be honest,
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Great. Well, thank you guys both so much for sitting down together and talking through this process. Mm-hmm. This has been amazing.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank
you. Yeah, thanks so much.
I'm Melody Edwards. That was Kelly Schroeder from Better Wyoming and Peter Bishop with the Albany County Conservancy. You can watch a video of their full conversation at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. The Albany County Commissioners now have 45 days to make their decision.
When we come back, teens in Wyoming and elsewhere have gotten vaccinated. This is Open Spaces.
One thing we're proud of here at Wyoming Public Media is our podcasts. Whether you're looking for a good story from human nature,
I was convinced some of them are going to die,
or you want to hear our region in unexpected ways through the modern West.
When women teach women, we're saving relationships one cast at a time.
We've got a whole world waiting for you online. Explore under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. This month, 12 to 15-year-olds have started getting vaccinated against COVID-19. The Mountain West News Bureau spoke with some newly vaccinated and soon-to-be vaccinated kids. Savannah Marr and Madeline Beck bring us this audio postcard from kids in our region and their motivations for getting the shot.
Hi, my name is Taylor DiNiazzi.
I'm Ezra Visser.
My name is Molly Buckles.
My first name is Oliver, and my last name is Rogers.
Hello, my name is Shandine Willie.
A week ago, about, I got the vaccine.
I was a little bit scared, not because of the symptoms or anything. I just have a fear of needles.
At first, I didn't want to get it. Because I was scared, because I thought I was still going to get the virus or something.
I wanted to get it pretty much right away, just because not only I knew I had at least some type of protection against COVID.
I was like, okay, maybe it's not all that bad. Maybe I should get it. I haven't gotten a shot in a while.
That's okay. It'll be nice and easy. Do you want to let your arm hang nice like a spaghetti noodle?
Yeah.
Okay. Ready? It's not all that bad. Let's see.
Did it sting?
A little bit.
A little bit?
It didn't hurt like I thought it would. I feel relieved.
It feels exciting because a year ago today, we didn't even have a vaccine. And now I'm just getting like closer to the second dose day by day.
When COVID was still like outraging, like we couldn't hang out with any friends or do anything because such a bad virus and we didn't want to take it home.
Whenever I would go to the store, I would just be in constant fear of like touching something and then someone who probably has the virus has touched that.
I think I'm more of a germaphobe now.
It was a struggle too with school because of how hard it was like online and stuff.
It's been so hard and tiring and draining.
It was much harder to focus than when I was in school normally.
I wouldn't want to do it again.
I haven't been able to do as much sleepovers or hangouts with my friends.
When we're all in person, we just like to talk and like laugh, but then like over the phone, it's different.
We mostly just like met in parks and hung out outside.
This past week, I went out with my friends finally and I got to see them again. It made me feel happy because I haven't seen anyone besides my family this whole entire pandemic. And just seeing them again just like made me want to cry, but I didn't want to in front of them. So I was just kind of happy the whole entire time.
So getting the vaccine will help me do that again.
I'm also looking forward to playing sports again.
I wanted to play football when I'm fully vaccinated.
Restaurants, because there are a couple really good ones in town that I have definitely missed eating at.
I'm looking forward to going back to school in person and not online.
The concerts and the traveling again. I've been really wanting to see Harry Styles and then Billie Eilish too with her new tour that's coming up.
I know that most of my friends have been vaccinated.
I actually talked to some of my friends and they actually don't want to get it.
They probably should get it just for like their parents' safety and relative safety.
It doesn't really hurt, it's just a slight pinch. And it's been tested on other kids, like 12 or 15, and they've been fine.
After you get it, you're just gonna feel more free and safe.
It didn't take much to get some more safety in my life.
Those were the voices of 15-year-old Taylor Deniazi of Gallup, New Mexico, 14-year-old Ezra Visser from Laramie, 13-year-old Molly Buckles from Cody, 12-year-old Oliver Rogers from Boise, Idaho, and 14-year-old Shadine Willie from Shiprock, New Mexico. A Wyoming-based mother and son duo published their first fiction novel back in 2019. The book largely centers around topics and impacts of mental health. Now Mary Billiter and Kyle Thomas are back at it with a second book. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao has more.
The book is called A Divided Twin, but it is actually a sequel to A Divided Mind. So can you talk a little bit about what A Divided Mind is, and then what got you to write or to create sequel to that first book?
So A Divided Mind came about when Kyle, senior year in high school, 2015, came to me and admitted that he was hearing voices. And so the mom and me wanted to make them go away, and Kyle wanted to have answers. So we traversed this whole road of mental health together, and I really found the journalist in me come to the forefront, and I just kept asking him questions while he was playing video games, trying to find out, like, you know, as a parent, you just don't want anything to be wrong with your child. I looked at the mental health diagnosis really frighteningly, and Kyle totally embraced it. And so we navigated this road together and wrote A Divided Mind. And what we were able to do was exercise all those demons that Kyle never acted on with his affective schizophrenic disorder. So we were able to really go into some areas of what if, and what if a mind is left undivided, and go from there. And from there came The Divided Twin, because our publisher really wanted a follow-up.
I got to really voice some symptoms I was having. When I was in high school, I got to be able to voice it correctly with many of the journal entries that were inside the book of Divided Twin. A lot of them are reflective on some things that happened when I was going through mental illness. And I thought it would be illustrated best in that kind of mindset through the book. And if anyone was kind of relating toward those kind of symptoms or having doubts, like, I hope that they would be able to read this book and kind of get a grasp or somewhat idea that it's not completely unnormal for someone to be like having that kind of the struggle, I guess, of mental illness, and like how they should just seek help or do whatever they can to address it as early as possible. So for me, The Divided Twin and The Divided Mind were just a good way to get my personal history of mental illness out there. And that's how we got to create these two books.
That being said, so now I'm curious, how did you both decide what you wanted to incorporate from real life and what you didn't want to incorporate from real life?
We had to like choose like a fine line to not incorporate some things that I was going through, because there are some stuff that's not included that was pretty dark at the time. For me, it was choosing what would be best in the book while also trying to keep some secrecy on what happened with mine. Or whenever I wrote the entries in Divided Twin, I kind of had to go back into history of some of the darker stuff I was going through. And I had to bring me to like a very kind of negative state of mind to be able to write that. So I wasn't all cheery, like, oh, let's go write about this trouble pass I went through. I had to bring myself to a very, very dark place to kind of be able to write and revisit my past, which is good in a sense to revisit all that's happened. But at the time I was like, I don't know if I want to do this. So it was very difficult to decide whether to write this.
And I think that we always used one degree of separation. So there is a lot of similarities. As his co-author, I really had to separate myself from being his mom to being his co-author. And that really helped me. So that was my one degree of separation, that I'm a fiction author, so this is what I do well. And integrating his voice into it, in fact, his voice is entirely in it, was how I showed up to make this happen. So there was a lot that was drawn on, just I think to tap into some structural things for us. but there was a lot we didn't delve into, which I'm glad that you realized that we really did keep that one degree of separation for us.
Kyle, like you described how challenging and difficult this process was, but what kept both of you going?
For me, it was if someone who may be going through similar things is to read this book and kind of have some kind of peace of mind through it, that they're not alone in like the battle for mental illness. That kind of really kept me motivated. I'm like, if that can help at least one person, then that doesn't bother me to have to go back and revisit my past. Like, I thought that had more value to it than me having to worry about like the stuff that associates with writing these kind of books, like the dark undertone of it and all that stuff. So for me, it was just, if I'm able to help someone, like that's, I feel like that has more weight to it.
I would say the thing that propelled me was a deadline. I'm very deadline oriented. So even when I didn't want to, I was like, Kyle, we've got a deadline. Like, you know, our publisher is expecting this.
If you could explain why is it important for these books to be out there in the world?
A lot of books I've read that regard to mental illness, it doesn't seem like it's coming from a realist like kind of standpoint. So I feel like these books do a good job to really kind of get to the grit of mental illness and how it's just not like, oh, take some medication, you're fine, and then you'll live your days and be happy and stuff like that. It's like, no, there's more to it than just simply finding a good doctor, a good medication. I feel like it addresses some areas that some other books or some other topics might not cover 100%. And like I said, it's coming from someone who actually went through it. I'm sure there are authors out there that I probably just haven't read who have had mental illness and correctly portray it. But it does help to have someone who's gone through it to kind of reflect on that into their writing. So I feel like that's what these books did.
Mary Billiter and Kyle Thomas, thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thanks, Nina.
Mary Billiter and Kyle Thomas will hold a book signing for A Divided Twin at Cheyenne's Barnes & Noble Bookstore on Saturday, June 12th. That'll start at 10 in the morning. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear a replay or get individual segments at wyomingpublicmedia.org or on our Facebook page. Open Spaces is also available on podcast through all the usual places. Anna Rader is our digital editor. Please support our Wyoming news effort with your contribution via our website. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.